about the socialism which captured so many young people as an alternative to the liberal society of the establishment in the end of the century. But now, as we come to the end of the First World War, I said that I would proceed by general movements from 1918. Socialism and the Jews, fascism and the Jews, and then the Jewish attitudes themselves. When we now come to socialism and the Jews, what we are interested in immediately are the attitudes of socialism, not the attitudes of the Jews. They are to a certain extent interwoven, but the interwovenness will appear in what I have to say. Now, it is true, in a sense, that the Jewish question played a minor role in leftist thought between the wars. But it did so in a way as part of an iceberg which determined left attitudes towards many problems, including the Jewish problem themselves. As we come to socialism and the Jews, we must remember that the attitude towards the Jews was an integral part of the general socialist attitude to men and society. As such, it was highly significant during the time of the Weimar Republic in Germany, especially, but not only, and it has a continuing significance today. We must therefore deal, somewhat in order, with several of the important socialist moves. Three, in fact: social democracy, communism, and the left-wing intellectuals, most of them Jewish themselves. But before we deal with these people, the social democrats, communists, and left-wing intellectuals before the war, I today have to go back to an earlier period. So the attitude of socialists or Jews was set in a way, not only in a way, it was set from the beginning of the century on. And I must first talk about that person who determined these attitudes, whose works and writings determined. And that person was Kalkowski. The name Kalkowski won't mean anything to you much, and I'm afraid if it means something to you, it is at the enemy of Lenin. You will find him quite different. Lenin stole from him at the moment, as far as we're concerned. But the enemy of Lenin. Kautsky, however, was for 30 years the most important theoretician in the socialist movement, not only in Germany. He was called rightly the Pope of Socialism, and that was certainly true. He had been Engels' private secretary. He was a link between Marx and Engels and German socialism, but not only German socialism, socialism in general. Therefore, Kautsky's analysis of the Jewish question were spread beyond German-speaking countries, and they were spread in the last resort by men like Lenin and Stalin and by the Communist Party. But here we must be clear about something else. Kautsky determined socialist attitudes towards Jews, except in France. For in France, the matter was different from the beginning. In France, the socialist tradition was not a Marxist one, but rather one from Proudhon and people whom you've read about in George Lichtenstein's article. Therefore, while the Marxist tradition prevailed in Germany, in France, anti-Jewish attitudes in socialism had much greater play, for they derived straight from Proudhon and Fourier, people you read about and with whom anti-Semitism was pronounced, there it was an integral part of their socialism. But the influence of the kind of French socialism George Lichtheim discusses, that influence did not penetrate beyond France. Fourier, Proudhon, these were purely French phenomena. It was Kautsky who determined it everywhere else, and eventually even in the French Socialist Party itself. I realize, and you realize, that Karl Marx was the first to deal with the Jewish question. But Kautsky gave it its modern socialist formulation. It comes in an article written in 1903. The article called The Massacre of Kishinev, the Russian Pogrom, and the Jewish Question. Now this article of 1903, The Massacre of Kishinev, and the Jewish Question, that article is based on Karl Marx's pamphlet of 1844, a pamphlet I have talked to you about before. Kautsky accepts the thesis of Marx's pamphlet that throughout the evolution of the history, Jews had become the representatives of the worst aspect of capitalism, the fetishism of goods, love of money, and devotion to commerce. Moreover, he accepts Marx's contention that Judaism as a religion is merely an objectification of commercial transactions. I'm not going to repeat what I talked to you about before, and I did. Judaism as a religion as an objectification of commercial transactions. Kautsky's own contribution did not change the fundamental direction of this analysis, but it updated it, if you like. It updated Marx's 19th century tract. The Jews are an urban people. Kautsky again and again emphasizes this point. And therefore they show all the particularities or peculiarities of their milieu, their urban milieu. In his later book, Race and the Jewish Question, Rassel und Judentum, Race and the Jewish Question of 1914, out of this milieu, he attributes a negative, critical, and dissolving spirit of the Jew to this milieu. And that I want to emphasize, it's going to be important later on. The negative, as he puts it, dissolving, self-letzender the German, dissolving spirit of the Jew to this milieu. Now it is clear, and I want to remind you, that Marx and Kautsky continue a tradition begun in the Enlightenment of the 18th century, remember. The Jew who was faithful to his Jewishness was wholly corrupt, an evil force in society, who must be re-educated to shed its Jewishness and enter the age of progress and enlightenment. Marx, in 1848-4, did not stress re-education, because the end of Judaism would come, of course, with the triumph of socialism. And so there was no need to stress, as Dohm and others who studied stress, the re-education of Jews. But Kautsky is different. For Kautsky, the revolution was in the future, and therefore he was closer to the Enlightenment. For he believed that the Jewish masses have to be educated and enlightened in order to counteract their Judaism. Their crucial concern, which he shares with Marx, we can summarize it that this way. The Jews, remaining Jews, were alienated from their humanity. For Kautsky and Marx, this humanity was of crucial concern. Jews as Jews were alienated from their own humanity by their involvement with capitalism by their religion, by the prison of their past. The phrase that Kautsky uses is a phrase that would have a great socialist future before it. The phrase, the vanishing of Judaism. The phrase, the vanishing of Judaism, will be repeated by many socialists. It meant, therefore, not only the vanishing of the Jewish religion, but also an end to Jewish peculiarities of devotion to commerce and a negative spirit, as Kautsky put it. Now, Kautsky and all socialists always looked at the Jews from the standpoint of Western culture, to which the socialists, despite their revolutionary vocabulary, were deeply committed. The enlightenment of the East European Jewish masses would serve to elevate them to the plateau of Western culture. That you had to do first for Kautsky, and then eventually through more than re-education, through socialist education, the vanishing of Judaism would become a reality. As he puts it, in race and Judaism, the Jews would become a modern people. And he fully, of course, accepted, as did all socialists, the stereotype of the ghetto about which we have talked before. Moreover, socialists adopted, and this is very often forgotten, Lamarckian biology. That is to say, the idea that through the evolution of the environment, you can change the species. Lamarckian biology is very basic. It's the wrong biology, we know, but it's very basic to socialist thought. So it was to Kautsky in this instance. Physical factors he did take into consideration. And, for example, he wrote with a great deal of enthusiasm about the necessary infusion of fresh peasant blood to strengthen the constitution of the Jewish urbanites. Well, don't look puzzled. A lot of people thought that in assimilation too. My father was always urging me to marry, if I could, a peasant. And in order to fresh up what was believed to be a declining constitution. But what the hell, you don't find many around here, unfortunately. I mean real peasants, not Rathskeller peasants. Real peasants. I'm still looking. I mean, of course, rich peasants. No idea of marrying a poor peasant is absurd. The idea of marrying poor anybody is absurd. Now, with all of this, you can be glad I'm not some of your father. Nothing for now. The question, however, is this then. What you have on the whole then is even in socialism, an intrusion of a biological factor coming from their commitment to Lamarckian biology, which you would really only suppose in racism, but wrongly only really suppose in racism, as you can see from this Kautskyan theory. Finally, he held that the Jews were always strangers, they were bound to be strangers, and the only way that they could get rid of being strangers is by intermixing with the local population. In other words, intermarriage, which was another way, of course, for the vanishing of Judaism. Remember, we are now at a time when in intermarriage, the partner never converted to Judaism. That was unknown. That's quite a modern thing. But on the whole, what you have here in intermarriage, therefore, is another vanishing of Judaism. You vanish, you marry peasant blood, if you can. Given these premises, it is clear that a rejection of Zionism is obvious. For Kautsky, the Zionist movement merely reinforced Jewish peculiarities, Jewish urbanism, and Jewish isolation. The Zionist movement for socialists was connected with the ghetto, with the commercialism of what they called the medieval Jewish religion. Kautsky never changed his mind on it. Kautsky indeed is famous for never changing his mind about anything. At the very time after 1918, when his star was being eclipsed, his analysis received new impetus. For the article on the Kishinev massacre was received with enthusiasm by Lenin. He not only reprinted it in Iskra, his paper, but based his own analysis of the Jewish question largely on Kautsky's earlier article. In turn, when Stalin came to write his tract on nationality, for which Lenin sent him to Vienna, the Jewish parts of it are again based on Kautsky. That is why Lenin and Stalin denied the Jews a peoplehood and nationality which they granted to us. That is, of course, important. Surely, given his premises, Kautsky was quite correct when he said, and Lenin repeated it, that Jews must not merely move from one medieval ruin to another. What they meant is from capitalism to Zionism, from one medieval ruin, as he put it, to another. Moreover, their disappearance should not be tragic, as it would be for the American Indians or the Tasmanians. Indeed, the disappearance of the Jews would, for individual Jews, mean greater power, well-being, and prosperity. I must suggest to you that from a socialist point of view, these ideas were undoubtedly fully justified. On several levels. First of all, as we already saw, the connection between socialism and nationalism is difficult, and Borochov and the other Zionists certainly turned and twisted enough. But moreover, the end product of socialism was to be a new humanity, a new man, encompassing Jews as well as all mankind, once capitalism had been abolished. Given the analysis of the Jew as the capitalist, the fetishism of goods, the middleman, given this analysis, truly, where the Jew is regarded as free and equal, he vanishes. This is a quote from Kautsky, but also a quote from Lenin. Socialist theory was reinforced then also by the Marxian theories of biological evolution, the materialist and environmental explanation of how life evolved on the planet. Socialism means a new environment, and in that new environment, Jews would cease to be Jews. They were therefore destined to a process of denationalization. One final argument must be added, one that Kautsky has, that Lenin and Stalin again copied. They had to face the fact, why the Jews, not the Czechs, Bohemians, American Indians, and Tasmanians? Why should those have peoplehood and the Jews not, even apart from the Jews' so-called undesirable quality? The answer was a territorial one. They had territory. The Jews had lost their territory hundreds of years ago, and it is hardly relevant anymore. Historical arguments of Jewish nationality were bound to be based on the Bible, and no socialist could accept an argument, obviously, based on that particular source. It's not only Kautsky and others. It is also Otto Bauer in Austrian Marxism who agreed with Kautsky's argument and thus justified the Austrian Empire's refusal to grant autonomy to its Jewish population. More important, Lenin and Stalin, of course, were ready to grant such autonomy to other suppressed nationalities, but not to the Jews, who were political rights. We must notice, therefore, that Kautsky was applied, Kautsky building on Marx with these special features that I have mentioned, was applied by Lenin and Stalin, but also by Austro-Marxism as well. Now, they rejected the model of autonomy. And what we must notice now is that Kautsky and others not only rejected Zionism, they also rejected any Jewish autonomy. That is obvious from the approach which I have tried to outline to you. This was bound to affect, after all, their relationship with the Jewish Bund, which you heard about last Friday, not only to the Zionists, but especially to the Bund, because the Bund was the most important Jewish socialist organization, after all. And what the Bund was after was Jewish autonomy, both in Poland and in the Austrian Empire, in Russia, then in Poland, and in the Austrian Empire. For the Jewish Bund, remember, autonomy was the solution, not territorialism. What they wanted eventually was a federal structure in which the Jews would be a part of this kind of federalism. What they stressed, the Bund, was not territory, but language, Yiddish, the language of the Jewish masses, the language of the Jewish proletariat. And in this, they came into conflict not only with Kautsky, but with all of socialists, Lenin in particular, for such ideas were, first of all, against his approach to the Jewish question, but secondly, against Lenin's idea of centralism, against the idea of centralism. For example, in the Jewish Bund, there was real democracy. There was probably the only socialist organism in Europe where there was real direct democracy, or what we would call participatory democracy, was in the Jewish Bund. But that was totally opposed to Leninism in every way. So it is that as well. Moreover, the Bund wanted to create new Jewish men, a new pride in Jewishness, under cultural autonomy. This, of course, is opposed to the proletarian unity and again to the idea that the Jews are not a separate nationality but a bad historical accident, is really the way to put it. The basic problem of the Bund wasn't played into all of this. What Lenin in his polemics never realized, a lot of things he didn't realize, is that the Bund was not really a working class organization in the Western sense. As Ezra Mendelsohn, in the only good book on the Bund called Class Struggle in the Pale, points out, the Jewish proletariat were in reality artisans, and it was almost impossible to force Jewish workers into factories. In other words, you weren't dealing here with a factory proletariat. You are dealing here, in fact, with an artisan proletariat. That is maybe why this democracy, that is maybe why this idea of autonomy. The Bund, in consequence, had to fight against the left as well as against the right, and eventually came into a position of utter isolation, not accepted by the left, not accepted by the right. For finally and in the end, it was Kautsky's view and Lenin's and Stalin's which prevailed on the Jewish and nationality question. We should say also the Austrian view of Otto Bauer. This view prevailed throughout the First World War, and it took on crisis proportions in 1916, in 1916. For in 1916, all this came to a climax. For the Jewish Zionists, proletarian party, the Poale Zion, applied for membership in the Second International. Now, the Poale Zion, a Jewish proletarian party, Voroshilov's party, Sirkin's party, the Jewish proletarian party, had always wanted to join the Second International. Why not? They thought themselves as Zionists, socialists. But in 1916, it produced a crisis because it faced the Second International with the problem again of Jewish autonomy. Could a Jewish organization be admitted? Now you must understand that the seats in the Second International were divided up on a territorial basis. Every country had so many seats. And therefore, what to do with the Jews? And again, the territorial argument becomes important even in the setup of the Second International, where it was distributed territorially. The result was an acrimonious debate, but the immediate result was the victory of the Kautsky line, but together with a compromise. And that is very typical. The Poale Zion was admitted to the Second International, but how? As a Palestinian territorial organization. What happened was that the Turks, the Turkish socialists, vacated two seats. The two Turkish seats were given to the Poale Zion with the explicit understanding that they are not a Jewish organization, but a Palestinian one. That was the trick. In other words, the territorial idea, the idea against Jewish autonomy in the Second International, won a victory and was certainly kept. They were not allowed to represent proletarian Zionist Jewry for ideas and reasons, which I think must now, be obvious. And yet, the Second World War was a problem. For during the Second World War, many socialists, above all Western socialists, again came in contact with the Eastern European masses. The Germans occupied the Pale, remember. And seeing the misery and the poverty and all of that, many socialists began to have a kind of change of heart. Because like Herzl earlier, they said, what shall be done to these people? Autonomy would be no solution. And this is true, of course. Autonomy would be no real solution. They saw the anti-Semitism in Poland. They saw the miserable way these people lived. But still more important, as a result of the war, as I told you before, as a result of the revolution after the war, led by Jews so very largely, as I told you last time, in Bavaria, in Hungary, in Berlin, Rosa Luxemburg, Jogaisches, all these people, led by Jews and mostly foreign Jews. These revolutions and all of this gave a great impetus to the right, as we shall see later, of course, to racism, to anti-Semitism. And that again caused some socialists to have second thoughts. What happened briefly is this. That socialists begin to split on the Jewish question as it begins to split in general. The communists, to whom we shall come in more detail a little later, the communists carried on the Kautsky tradition. Very sad for the old man, because the old man hated Bolshevism, hated Lenin, and the only people who really carried him on were precisely the Bolsheviks. They always copied him without giving the reference. They carried him on. Very sad for the old man. He didn't die till 1938. He was very old, very lonely, and saw himself betrayed by the Social Democrats. for it is the Social Democrats who made the fundamental revision in their attitude towards the Jewish question, while the Communists, and by this I mean the Bolsheviks as well, kept off the tradition I have just talked about, but it begins to bifurcate after 1819. For the Socialists, for the Social Democrats, very largely because of what they saw in Poland, very largely because of the increased anti-Semitism in 1918 to 1920. The man who was instrumental in that change was Eduard Bernstein, the revisionist. Eduard Bernstein, who really must be given the principal praise in the change of heart on the Jewish question. Already 1916, in the International, Second International, Bernstein had argued for the admission of the Poale Zion as a Jewish Zionist party. Now, Bernstein's evolution is, I think, significant. During its youth, the normal world had seemed to him the non-Jewish world, and the Jewish world the abnormal. That's, of course, true for most assimilated in the West. The Jewish world was, for them, the abnormal. Just before the war, he had condemned Zionism, like all socialists, as an ecstasy that would pass. Though even then he accused some socialists of having got Zionism into their head when they should know better. But the First World War in its aftermath changed his mind. And Kautsky was quite right to deplore that the war had given Zionism a new beginning. That was Kautsky's sad remark after the war, that the war had given Zionism a new beginning. True. But typically enough, in revising his stand on Zionism, Bernstein also revised Kautsky's picture of the Jews as a whole. Now that, I think, is very significant in coming to see Zionism as a possibility. He revised the whole picture of the Jew. He had to dismantle the whole classical view of the Jew, classical socialist of the Jew. As a matter of fact, Bernstein at the same time became ever more convinced of the importance of nationality as a sociological fact. And ever more at the same time, and I think you can see how it goes together, ever more at the same time accused the socialists of ignoring nationality. So his revising his attitude of Zionism, the Jews, goes together with his attitude towards nationality all during the First World War and then its aftermath, or during that. He believed, for example, that the idea of national autonomy was a socialist way to democracy. He believed that the idea of national autonomy had much more democratic socialist potential than centralism, than Lenin's kind of centralism. The Jews should, if they wanted, receive a Jewish nationality within individual European countries. And if they wanted, then why not have out of that Jewish nationality a Jewish state? For he believed, and he came to believe from socialism, a belief that is very similar to Martin Buber, that socialist humanity can only arise through the instrument of nationality, that eventually, through their nationality, people will reach a fusion with all of humanity. What Buber put in a spiritual, mystical way, Bernstein put in a socialist way, the abolition of capitalism. And in the abolition of capitalism, democratic revolutionary procedures me national economy, not centralism, and eventually a national state and humanism. So Bernstein became an ardent champion of Zionism. As he put it, a free human community on free soil. His contact man in Zionism was a young journalist called Zalman Rubashov. You know him better as Shazar, the president of Israel. Zalman Rubashov, I refuse to acknowledge these new names. Zalman Rubashov in Israel or here, again, name it. Zalman Rubashov wrote, for example, that when Kautsky raised accusations against the Jewish proletariat, by which he means the Poale Zion, Bernstein came to his defense. In gratitude, Rubashov wrote a pamphlet called The Three Greatest Jews. Who are they? LaSalle, Marx, and Bernstein. I had a long talk with him last summer about Bernstein, because he's one of the few people who know about that, and some things that I'm telling you about that, I can't tell it to you in such detail, come in fact with my talks with President Shazar, that is with Rubashov, about the links of socialism and Zionism, which are, he was really perhaps the key man in reporting about the three great Jews, LaSalle, on which in a way the Poale Zion kind of models, Marx, not much left, but there he is, the text is quite tortured on that, and Bernstein. Bernstein's Zionism, however, led it also to adopt a positive attitude towards the masses of East European Jewry, and that is significant. You see, he really had to get rid of all the classical socialist picture, including, of course, especially Marx's 1844 picture. As he put it, and it took some courage to say this, the Jews in their East European ghetto were just as moral as the Germans. Such a defense of the ghetto Jews begins to arise through much of social democratic literature. Never as you will see through communism. Through social democratic literature, it enabled socialists like Bernstein to engage in a straightforward defense against anti-Semitism. The kind of straightforward defense, and honest defense, in which the communists, as you will see, singularly failed and indeed could not really engaged. It is typically also the close relationship between such men and the Jewish effort at self-defense from 1918 to 1939. It has now been documented that the Social Democratic Press was the only political press that consistently used material given to it by the Central Organization of German Citizens of the Jewish Faith. That is, it was, typically enough, the Social Democratic Press, the only press which used this material given to it by the Jewish Defense League. No other German newspaper or press used it. Very, I think, significant. Bernstein's views, moreover, were forcefully expressed and shared throughout the fourth Social Democratic International. Men whom some of you may have heard, like Camille Huysmans or Emil van der Velde, all share these ideas, all became really advocates of Zionism, or at least friendly to Zionism. Van der Velde wrote a book, The Land of Israel, in 1929, subtitled A Marxist in Palestine, and he was a most important man, the secretary of the Fourth International. And there again, he praises Jews without oppression. That is, in a way, the essence. But typically enough, this now also gets an anti-Polish kind of thrust. Fundamentalist says the vitality of Zionist ideology is proof against the Bolsheviks, and we might add against Trotsky, who believed that economic considerations played a primary role in solving the Jewish question. Well, what is important for us now are unfortunately not the details, which are rather interesting. People will tell you of Bernstein, who was a sort of nice, avuncular person with a big white beard. He didn't die till 1932. Bernstein, this nice, avuncular person, as a kind of intermediary being talked to death by Rubashov. That I can imagine. Being talked to death by Rubashov, the nice, good uncle of the Zionist movement, which is a good description for old Bernstein. Arose. Now clearly, an important cadre of social democratic leadership was friendly to Zionism after the war. And that friendship to Zionism led them indeed to revise socialism on the Jewish question, to take a different view of the masses of East European Jewry, of the Jewish stereotype, namely to deny it. These men stood, of course, on the right wing of social democracy, because they were liquidating classical Marxism. And if you liquidate one part, you're going to liquidate another part, and Bernstein did. So they stood on the right wing of socialism, firmly on the right wing. For these attitudes, it meant not only a break with Marx's view on the Jewish question, but everything Orthodox socialism had developed since Marx's death. They tended, obviously, towards gradualism rather than revolution. And to the revolutionary movement, we come back the next time. And yet, it isn't that simple. I always have to tell you that, fortunately. In 1933, the leader of German Zionism, a man called Kurt Blumenfeld, declared that among social democrats, hardly any Jews are placed in public positions. That statement is subject to suspicion. Here was a Zionist, he didn't want any Jews placed in public positions. He didn't want Jews to have anything to do with Germany. So, obviously suspicion. But still, he had a point. He had a point. For while the Social Democrats never tried to beat the Nazis at their own game, as the Communists will try to do, still there were subtle pressures upon them, which they resisted and sometimes could not resist wholly. The obvious success of the German right in using anti-Semitic slogans put the Social Democrats evermore on the defensive. It had already been said, I'm sorry to say, in some of their pamphlets, that Marxism could not be merely a Jewish construct, because Engels was after all a Christian. And I am sorry to say that under that very subtle tightening of the atmosphere and rightist successes, you do find, even among social democrats, more and more stress on the Christian Engels, who, after all, was said to have swung the whole thing, than on the Jew, Karl Marx. The emphasis on Marx, an emphasis on Engels. But there may have been here a deeper problem, two deeper problems, which must for a minute concern us. The first is the problem of the intellectuals. And here we come into ethical socialism. Here we come into this question of a Berlin worker. What are intellectuals? Are they Jews? Secondly, the problem, well, the Weinberg is shaking his head, but let's hope for the best. On the whole, now, the sections must not be going too well. But on the whole, the second problem is equally clear. The problem of a misjudgment of national socialism. So then we must now go to the problem of the intellectual, which was part of the problem and to pressure, which had a definite relationship to the Jewish question. All these intellectuals were Jews, as we've already talked about that. And secondly, the misjudgment of socialism. Now, the relationship between the social democrats and the intellectuals was stormy, full of strain. Well, the relationship of any political organization and its intellectuals are stormy and full of strain, right? Right. So, that was nothing special. But what is special is that these were, of course, these ethical idealists with which we had to deal, these moralists, these ethical idealists, this kind of Jewish socialism. And if you're trying to run a political party, boy, that's tough. Very tough. Indeed, I might say, impossible. So, there is something to be said from the point of view of the stormy relationship of the social and democratic party. But there is even a little more to it than that. And I think to that, as a communist, I will come on Monday, or perhaps partly on Friday. But please, so before you go, there's nothing on, there's nothing to do in medicine anyhow, I don't want to run away. The thing is obviously quite clear. If you have any question in your mind, if you sit dreaming, please write them down so that you can ask them on Friday. Otherwise you will lose them, because there will be lots of things, including rich peasant girls that might get in your way.